So these are the villi, and we talk about the development of the villi themselves going through three stages, and I mentioned this in an earlier lecture before, and the three stages reflect the histological structures that are present within each villi. So the first one that forms in week two to three are the primary villi. And these consist just of the trophoblastic shell cells, the syncytia trophoblasts and cytotrophoblasts, extending or growing as finger-likes into the maternal decidua. These primary villi are transformed into secondary villi at about the third week in development. And what occurs in the third week of development to transform them? The establishment of mesoderm, gastrulation. So we have mesoderm following the fingers and filling them up. I like to imagine them as like a glove, and we're filling all the fingers of the glove now with mesoderm. So these structures that develop from the primary villi are the secondary villi, and the major difference is now that they're filled with extra embryonic mesoderm. Then finally, we have from that period on, from about week four onwards, when we begin to get vascularization of the splanchnic mesoderm within the embryo, these blood islands form on the yolk sac and the extra embryonic mesoderm around the chorion, and it transforms the mesoderm into blood islands. And now we have blood vessels forming in there, and the presence of blood vessels defines the tertiary villi. So a tertiary villi now has blood vessels within the mesoderm core of the villi. Now this process of primary to secondary to tertiary villi occurs in early embryonic development, but is recapitulated over and over again through embryonic and fetal development as new villi grow. So the villi grow out initially as the chorionic shell, mesoderm fills the core of it, that becomes vascularized, and we've formed a new villi. So this process is an ongoing process through all of embryonic and fetal development. We also classify the villi that form into two major types. The first we see are described as stem villi. And these are the ones here that we can see that form these attachment sites to the maternal decidua. So these actually form their physical attachment. If you didn't have that, then the whole placenta would be lost from the decidual lining of the uterus. So here are our stem villi here, and here's another one here. They're attached by a column of trophoblast cells. So trophoblast cells at the tip of these villi proliferate to form an extensive layer of trophoblast cells, and the maternal decidua generates an epithelial plaque to which they attach. So this is maternal here, and this is fetal here. So this is the actual interaction of the villi with the maternal decidua. So this epithelial plaque forms here, and we see the fibrinoid depositions behind here, which is also part of the transformation of the endometrium into the decidua. So this is a stem villi. It's also described as an anchoring villi because it anchors the placenta. So it means the same thing. A stem or an anchoring villi attaches the villi to the maternal decidua. Then we have, as these villi continue to grow and develop, we have branches that form on the lateral surface of the villi, so new villi forming on the lateral margins, and they're in essence doing the same thing that the respiratory tract does as it branches. It increases the surface area for exchange. So these branch villi or termini villi grow out from the sides of the stem villi and increase the overall surface area. They're not anchored to the maternal decidua. They're floating in the blood-filled space. So we've got it attached at its tip, and then a large number of branches that increase the overall surface area for exchange. In addition to that, I usually put it in here, but I haven't, there's a third form of villi, and the third form are the ones which float. That is, that they're not attached at their tips, but are floating in the maternal blood-filled space, and these are floating villi. They'll also form lateral branches as well. So we end up with a structure that looks like this, a term, and that is, here are our maternal blood vessels. they're opening into a space, a unique space here, which is filled with maternal blood. Now, these maternal blood vessels are pried open by a ring of trophoblasts around the end of them that prevent the blood vessel from spontaneously contracting and shutting down the arterial blood flow. So we see blood continuously flowing into this space, and we see the maternal venous return coming out from this as well. So this has an oxygen tension level in between oxygenated arterial blood and deoxygenated venous blood, somewhere between those two. Within it are our villi, some of them anchoring to the decidua, some of them floating freely in this space. And this structure that's formed here is a cotyledon. So this is a cotyledon, and these finger-like extensions down here are the septa, which separates this cotyledon from the nearby cotyledon here. So these are the individual cobblestones that we see on the maternal side. So inside this cobblestone, we've got a large number of villi, some of them anchoring, some of them floating, and all of them branched. And then as we come back here, we see the end of the space, the maternal blood-filled space, and on this side, this is the fetal side of the placenta, which consists of the fetal membranes of the amniotic membrane, now fused in with the chorionic membrane. So only at the side of the placenta here do we have just the amniotic membrane alone. As we move away from the placenta around here, the amniotic membrane and the chorionic membrane are fused together. So a single space now exists, which is the amniotic space. The blood vessels which are formed in the villi join together and run back into the cord, and this is our connecting stalk with, once again, the umbilical arteries wrapped around the umbilical vein, and the vein is bringing our oxygenated blood from the mother to the embryo. So the vein is our major supply of nutrients. The arteries, just like the pulmonary system, are taking waste products to the blood-filled space and exchanging it here. So if it was just blood exchange and oxygen exchange, it wouldn't be very interesting to talk about. But the placenta has many other roles to play in development of the fetus and interacting with the mother. So it's an interchange between the mother and the fetus and has an important role in fetal development. We know that in the early stages of implantation, the syncytia trophoblasts secrete HCG, which maintains the pregnancy. This HCG secretion goes off back to the ovary and maintains the corpus luteum and therefore maintains the decidua, maintains high levels of progesterone, and the pregnancy can continue. Later, as the fetus grows, the corpus luteum's role is taken over by the placenta. So the placenta takes over the endocrine support of the pregnancy, maintaining the mother in a state where she knows she's pregnant and not non-pregnant. So initially carried out by the corpus luteum and then replaced by the placenta. The placenta also carries out metabolism. The placenta can synthesize glycogen. It's involved in cholesterol metabolism and fatty acid metabolism. All of these can provide nutrient and energy for growth of the fetus. So the placenta is a powerhouse as well. It's a liver and stomach, doing all of the functions you'd describe for the adult liver occurring within the placenta. We've already talked about the transport role for placenta blood vessels, and that is we exchange oxygen with carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide, and we also exchange a whole range of other nutrients supplied by the mother. And this includes things you may not have already thought about, things such as water, glucose, vitamins, hormones that can be transferred across, mainly the steroid hormones, not the protein hormones. So there's a barrier. You've obviously heard of the placental barrier. It's not really a barrier. It's to do with the ability to exchange across the membranes. We also see exchange in the opposite direction, the waste products coming from the fetus. So large amounts of urea, because the fetus can't excrete it from its kidney other than into the amniotic sac, so it has to get rid of its nitrogenous waste products through the placenta. uric acid and bilirubin. Of course, bilirubin being the breakdown product of hemoglobin once we are finished with our red blood cells. The other things which can cross the placenta, which we're not terribly keen about, are the following, and that is that drugs that the mother may be taking, if they're soluble within the bloodstream, can be transferred to the infant as well and accumulate in the infant because it has no way of getting rid of those. So it's the clearance rate is nowhere near as much as the mother. And also the metabolites of the drugs. Once again, the mother can excrete them through her kidney and get rid of them, but unfortunately the infant can't. And so this leads often to the cases where you've heard about fetal drug addiction, because things like cocaine and other types of drugs and heroin can be transferred across that placental membrane and lead to a prenatal addiction to the fetus. In addition to that, there are a range of infectious organisms which have managed over time to cross the placental barrier and lead to fetal infections. And these can lead to quite serious developmental effects. Fetal infections are teratogenic, leading to abnormal development of the embryo. And the ones you've probably already heard about are rubella, cytomegalovirus, measles, and other organisms. In addition to that, in tropical places, malaria can infect the placenta separately from the fetus. So the fetus, you can have what's known as a malarial infection of the placenta. So I'll talk about this with abnormalities if I don't prattle on too much. I obviously like the placenta too much. In terms of the endocrine roles, let's go through this. I've talked about HCG already. It has a role like luteinizing hormone and supports the corpus luteum. And then a range of other hormones are made by the placenta. So human chorionic somatotrophin, or HCS, is often also described as placental lactogen. And what its role is to increase maternal blood flow through the pregnancy, and it decreases maternal insulin sensitivity. So you want to maintain high levels of glucose in the maternal bloodstream in order to provide nutrient to the developing fetus, much higher than you'd normally be maintaining in the normal adult in a non-pregnant state. So it generates an insensitivity to insulin, and so insulin levels would normally be increased to decrease that circulating sugar level. And so it's often described as an anti-insulin function. So during a pregnancy, a mother becomes resistant to insulin. And we won't talk about diabetes. There are conditions in pregnancy known as gestational diabetes, where the extra load that's placed upon the mother leads to a diabetic condition in the mother that only occurs during the pregnancy. HCT is a placental hormone which is similar to thyroid-stimulating hormone. So it, along with HCG, is thought to act on the maternal thyroid and, once again, alter the mother's metabolism, so changing her metabolic rate during the pregnancy. But there's not a lot known about this particular hormone's other roles. Then a hormone that's similar to the adrenal gland, ACTH, and it's thought to have similar ACTH-like activities, increasing maternal cortisol levels. So this has not only anterior pituitary and pancreas-type roles, but now we're talking about adrenal-type roles of the placenta.
They're not called human in whatever, are these studies, or were they discovered via human
placenta? No, some of these occur also in animal models, but obviously if we're talking about human placentation, I'm talking about the human equivalent. So there'd be a mouse equivalent. It can be slightly different in terms of the regulation that occurs there. In addition to that, the placenta's the major source for steroid hormones. So the fetus can generate the precursors to a lot of the steroidal hormones, but it's transformed within the placenta to the active form of the steroidal hormone, which can be released back in. So things like the estrogens are transformed within the placenta, and these steroidal hormones are quite important for fetal development. So the fetal endocrine function is important for normal development. Then finally, the last one, which I always like to talk about, relaxin. I feel so comfortable, nice and relaxed. This relaxin hormone's been described to have many different roles. Originally, it was thought just to have a role in softening tendinous junctions, such as the pelvic fusion at the front, the pubic symphysis, so that the pelvis will flex and allow easier delivery. That's one of the reasons why mothers get sort of problems during late in the pregnancy because all of their tendons are being loosened up. But it's thought that it has other roles to play as well in terms of the angiogenesis, that is, development of blood vessels. So the two hormones, I've mentioned one of them a lot to you already, which is the HCG that come from the trophoblasts. But there is a second hormone from the trophoblasts as well, which is called placental growth hormone, or PGH. It's a peptide hormone of only 13 amino acids, and its major role is to lead to the development of the placenta itself. So from those early villi that form, its role seems to be multifunctional, both in the transformation of the maternal decidua and also the proliferation of villi. So this is another hormone that's secreted by the trophoblasts in addition to the HCG. So they're the two main trophoblastic hormones. I've already talked a lot about decidualization, so I won't go through that again, which is the transformation of the stromal cells into the special functional cells of the placenta. I've mentioned also about artery dilatation because of the trophoblasts keeping them open. But there are also a whole range of other changes that are occurring uniquely within the uterus related to the immune function, the presence of a large number of natural killer cells here, a large number of cytokines being released locally in that region, and some endoreplication, which is rounds of DNA duplication without cytokinesis. So similar to the formation of syncytia trophoblasts, we end up with multinucleated cells there. So in the last 10 minutes, I'd like to talk about a few of the abnormalities that can occur with placentation. I've talked about the development of villi, the two surfaces, the hormonal roles and the other functions of the placenta. Let's now talk about some of the types of things that can go wrong in placentation. And this image here outlines the major forms of abnormalities of placentation. So first one here, the most common one over here, accretia, is where rather than invading the uterine lining, it forms this superficial structure on the lining of the uterus and doesn't invade deeply enough to gain access to the blood vessel. So placental accretia is probably one of the most common forms of abnormal forms of implantation. The normal one we can see here has a correct development of the stratum basalis, which is the layer which is transformed by decidualization. So in this case here, this is absent. Here's a normal placenta occurring in the vast majority of the cases. The other abnormality of placentation is when the invasion goes deep, but not so deep as to puncture the muscular layer, and this is called increcia. Occurs in about 17% of placentation abnormalities, and there, and this we once again see this basalis layer not being present and the invasion going too deep. And once again, it leads to abnormalities in terms of the vascularization and the formation of the blood-filled lacunae. And the most serious of the implantation abnormalities is paracretia. It's a not very common abnormality. And what happens in this case is the syncytia trophoblasts invade right through the wall of the uterus, right through the myometrium. So this is the myometrial layer here. In increcia, we go into the myometrial layer. And you've probably heard about a condition that occurs not in pregnancy but during the normal menstrual cycle called endometriosis, which is where this functional layer of the uterine lining gets embedded within the muscular layer and goes through the normal changes every menstrual cycle and can be quite a major reproductive problem for women. But going back to precretia, this is where the syncytia trophoblasts now have gone right through the muscular layer into the peritoneal cavity here. No, it's extremely difficult to treat these things. No.
Will the embryo fill the basalis properly?
In some cases, termination may occur, particularly if there's a risk for maternal health, as might occur in paracresia. So it's dealt with on a case-by-case thing clinically. These are implantation abnormalities. What are the only other abnormalities that I haven't shown you here? No? And we've talked about it already in terms of a major abnormality. Yes, ectopic. So if the placentation event occurs out in the uterine horn, then these ectopic pregnancies have to be terminated because placenta won't complete its normal development, and nor can the embryo without the mother dying. And there are a series of ectopic or abnormal implantation sites within the uterus, and the most common or serious one is the one which occurs when placenta forms across the inner os of the cervix, and this condition is known as what? Anyone heard of the term placenta previa before? Placenta previa. In placenta previa, the placentation occurs across the os. The placenta can form normally, but what's one of the problems you can see with this process? This is the way out. Okay? And if you formed a placenta across the internal surface of it, as soon as you begin labour and you begin opening the cervix, you're going to then get separation of the placenta from the uterine lining and lots of blood loss and fetal demise. So in placenta previa, in the third trimester, mothers in placenta previa often spend a great deal of time bedridden or not moving around in order to try and maintain it, and they're often delivered by caesarean or delivered early because of these problems that can occur in labour. There is a second modification of this, which is called vasa previa. And in vasa previa, the placenta is close to the os down here. So the placenta doesn't actually cover the opening of the inner cervical opening. But what occurs is the placental cord blood vessels transit across the opening. So the placenta is beside it, but the cord blood vessels cover the opening. So during the final end of the delivery, the fetus pushes down on it and occludes the cord blood vessels and blocks them, and this can lead to blocking of the blood supply to the fetus as well with a serious ramifications. So that's vasa previa. So I've described the different abnormalities here, and here's an example from the 17th century, so they obviously described it back then for midwives, of a placa previa. And you can see here's the placenta in this region here, across the inner os, the os is being opened, and of course the head of the infant's being pushed down on the placenta as well, and this will block circulation to the fetus. So obviously if you block the circulation for long enough, the fetus will become oxygen starved and lead to stress upon the fetus and neuronal death mainly, and eventually fetal death. I've talked also about a hydatiform mole, which is an abnormal placentation event, where only the placenta forms and not the embryo. So in hydatiform mole, we just see all the trophoblastic cells forming and no embryo formation within it. And I'll show you the ultrasounds that detect this process as well. There are also cord abnormalities. And here's a cord at delivery. We'll look at this histology in the lab today. But one of the abnormalities which is often described is cord knotting. Here's a knot in a cord here. It occurs very rarely, about in 1% of most cases we see it. And in many cases, such as this one here, unless the knot tightens, then it's not a big issue. It doesn't occlude the blood vessels. The blood vessels are quite a large diameter. It's only a small number of them where occlusion occurs. The second type of cord abnormality is cord torsion, and this is a stretching or a twisting of it, and this is more is also a way of blocking them, because as it's stretched and twisted, the blood vessels are narrowed and blocked by their own twisting, just as you twist a cord. So this cord torsion is another abnormality. A third form of abnormality associated with the cord doesn't affect cord circulation, but it affects fetal development, and that is if the cord gets wrapped around a structure, it can lead to truncation of limbs or if it's wrapped around the neck, for example, it can lead to blockage of circulation to the head. So there is certain cases of the association with the cord around the fetus itself. I mentioned infections, and these are red blood cells infected with the parasite that causes malaria. And of course, the placenta is filled with maternal red blood cells and brings all of these parasites there, and therefore they can infect the trophoblast and cytotrophoblast embryonic component of the placenta as well. So placental malaria is quite a serious condition, and there's a lot of research going into ways of treating this because it leads to abnormalities in development. In addition to that, a lot of bacteria can cross. So listeria are known to cross the placenta. This is why it's suggested that mothers don't eat non-pasteurised cheeses or non-pasteurised products in the first trimester, because listerial infection, if anyone's ever had one, is quite a serious infection of the gastrointestinal tract. But if it invades the placenta and infects the placental tissues, can lead to a teratogenesis as well. In addition to bacteria and these parasites crossing, we know there are a number of viruses which can cross, the most serious of which every girl in this room's been immunised for, which is... I'd have to say rubella would probably be the most serious viral infection that you can see that you've been immunised for. Was it RRM or MMR or something is the one you would have gotten? And it was actually, its teratogenic effects were discovered by an Australian doctor back in 1940s, and he saw a great correlation during the rubella infections that were coming through with a series of births that were occurring 9 months after the infections, and led to serious neurological defects of blindness, deafness, and so on. So there are quite serious neurological defects with viral infections that are transferred across the placenta. And I always like to mention the Australian input to it, discovered by an Australian in terms of the rubella effects. You don't need to know about the placental pathology here for this course. I've just included it as background information for you. So.